Don't dream it. Be it. You best believe I'm not going to ignore the irony of Tim Curry encouraging people to be it, given his role as Pennywise that was to come later in his career. But what I really want to focus on is what the song is actually about. Frankenfurter, played by Tim Curry, is a self-anointed sweet transvestite from transsexual Transylvania. Now, I acknowledge that it's 2025, but I'm going to ask everyone to put aside the outdated terminology just for a moment. This was, of course, 1975, when the Rocky Horror Picture Show released in cinemas. Strictly speaking, it appears that Frank is a cross-dresser, to use modern parlance, as opposed to a transgender woman. For the point of this discussion, I'm going to do the most cisgender man thing in the whole entire world and lump them together. It's what we do. Trans representation in 1975 is a pretty miraculous thing, there's no question about it. And in the song Fanfare / Don't Dream It, Frankenfurter takes the stage in full drag and with some dead animal slewed around his neck to talk about his desire to wear the dresses of Faye Ray, hugging his thigh the way it did for Faye back in the 1930s. Don't dream it. Be it. Frank sings this over and over and over again. Don't dream it. Be it. The LGBTIQA+ community took this as a call to arms. Don't just feel the way you feel. Be the way you feel. Be loud. Be proud. Be you. Don't dream it. Be it. The man who wrote that song is trans, having described themselves as a 70% male and 30% female much later in his career. His name is Richard O'Brien. Unfortunately, he's also a TERF, saying that trans women are not and can never be real women. So that's obviously very confusing and I think unnecessarily hurtful coming from a trans person and coming from the person who wrote the Rocky Horror Picture Show and all of its songs. And Frankenfurter is his creation, of course, along with Tim Curry, who created the character as the performer. It begs the question, is all representation a good thing? Even though not technically trans, Frankenfurter is maybe the most famous piece of trans representation in cinema history. He is also a murderer, a rapist, a literal alien, and a sex freak. In a world where representation for trans people is rare, especially in 1975, can these kinds of stereotypes do more harm than good? I suppose I'll just ask the question. It's probably not for me to answer. I've read many accounts of trans people about this movie, and many love Frankenfurter, while acknowledging how problematic he is, and they adore the film. However, many trans people feel the representation helped establish and perpetuate harmful stereotypes that feel as loud and as present as they ever have. I suppose that's what makes the Rocky Horror Picture Show interesting and worth examining 50 years later. I'm Bo Nicholson and this is Movieversaries. Yes, this is Movieversaries. I'm Bo Nicholson. This is where we celebrate and sometimes reevaluate some of the greatest movies ever on a significant anniversary. On this episode, we're discussing the Rocky Horror Picture Show, perhaps the most iconic cult classic musical ever, on its 50th anniversary. To help me discuss the film, well, she was walking down the street just to having a think when I gave her an evil wink. It's Violet Hammond. Hello, Violet.
Hello. Don't make me sing that whole thing because you know I will. You guys are going to have to hold me back a lot today.
I have very much not written that many notes today because I know that you guys will just take the lead on this one and I'm just going to like have a long leash, I think. And, well, it's not just you, of course, and it's not just me. It's his pelvic thrust that really drives you insane. It's Andy Williams. Hello, Andy.
It's just a jump to the left.
And then a step to the right.
Yeah, although exactly. Let's not take any steps to the right with the current view of the world at the moment. We don't have Ian Buckley with us right now, but he has promised to send through some thoughts from another dimension, perhaps with voyeuristic intentions. So we'll be hearing from Ian Buckley a bit later on. But let's talk about the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Brad and Janet get engaged with the magic of song at someone else's wedding, which is never tacky and always great. They decide to head off to visit a friend of theirs, but the night is long and the conditions are terrible. Their car no longer works, so they head off together to seek shelter at a mansion they saw, which is inhabited by a bunch of sex freaks, none more than the owner of the mansion, Frankenfurter, a crossdresser who is a little bit into the old ultraviolence. He sings, he dances, he clones people, he does other things that carry a trigger warning for sexual violence. Then Meatloaf inexplicably breaks through a wall with a motorcycle, sings a song while dry humping a character. He then gets murdered with an axe, which is moved on from pretty quickly, before a series of events leads to the death and destruction of many of the occupants of the mansion, some as young as just 7 hours old, already with a couple of notches under their belt, before the mansion returns to their home planet of transsexual Transylvania. So all in all, pretty straightforward. The Rocky Horror Picture Show is directed by Australian legend Jim Sharman, with songs by Richard O'Brien, who both New Zealand and Britain seem to be trying to disown with his extremely ironic views of trans people, given he is one. It has an IMDb rating of 7.4 out of 10 and a lukewarm Metascore of 65 out of 100. But there is no denying the love with which this film is held, particularly by the LGBTIQA plus community, where it is regarded as a key piece of media representation from an era where representation was a lot more rare. Now, none of us are trans or cross-dressers or anything like that, so a bit of a disclosure there for everybody at home that we are cis people talking about this movie, but I would love to know what this film means to our panel. I'll start with you, Miss Violet Hammond.
Ooh. Well, I mean, the short answer is so much. So, like, I remember being shown this when I was, I'm pretty sure, my first year of high school, in terms of how I was now in drama club in high school, and I had older friends for the first time, older friends who had already seen this. And this is kind of like one of the sacred texts of being a theater kid, a queer kid. Like, this is something you need to see. So I saw this probably at 14 with a group of older kids, learned all the call outs, had the time of my life. Like, I mean, loved it from the word go. I've seen this movie probably, like, it would be easy to say hundreds of times. This and the stage show, because I've done midnight screenings of the movie. I've done midnight showings of the stage show. I've dressed up as many
for
of the characters. I did. That's true. I love this movie so very much.
You mentioned the call-outs. Yes. So that's something that happens during the midnight screenings, isn't it? Where, yeah, like, Janet will be on, like, Janet is mentioned, they'll call her a slut or something. Or
correct, just, yeah.
Yeah.
You basically scream slut for 2 hours. Yeah.
There's many different aspects.
There's a lot of different call-outs.
Rad asshole and all that. And
describe, yes, your balls and, yeah.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Black, well, it sounds like you're pretty familiar too, Andy.
So I came to it relatively late. I think I've said before when we were talking Wicked on Real Talk, Violet, that I didn't really go and pay too much attention to musicals before I started dating my now wife. She told me I knew nothing about Rocky Horror except for the song The Time Warp. Mm-hmm. So she took me to a stage performance of it in the snow in, I think it was like a February time in Bristol. And I looked around and there were people in costumed suspenders. Mm-hmm. Like, it didn't matter that it was snowing. Yep. It was, these people were still in costume. And I looked around and I thought, I don't know what I'm getting into. Like, is this like an eyes wide shut situation? Where is she taking me? And
so, wait, hang on. Stop right there. So you've seen Eyes Wide Shut before you've seen Rocky Horror Picture Show.
I'd written my dissertation by this point.
that seems intuitively backwards, doesn't it? But go on, proceed.
And then from there, I sort of went along and enjoyed the stage show. And then because I'd enjoyed the stage show, we watched her oft-watched DVD and started listening to the soundtrack that she had held in her car since year dot. So kind of by osmosis did I fall in love with the film. But it wasn't, it's not quite as formative as it seems to be for you, Violet.
Yeah. I mean, I've just had another episode recording that's going to be going out on the feed. And like Rocky Horror Picture Show and Grey Gardens are the two things that they show you when you are a kid as part of the queer community. Those are the two.
And we did Rent.
Touchstones.
That was the last episode we did.
And we did Rent. Yeah. We are swimming in representation. Yeah. Oh, there's so much theater kid happening lately. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very particular flavor that you bring to the show that I don't.
Aren't you glad?
The guy with the Instagram handle Snob Bo over here. Just
tell us, what did you think of the musical masterpiece that is Bohemian Rhapsody?
Oh boy,
them's fighting words. Them's fighting words. I know that you're joking. I see. But this is the thing, Andy. This is insidious. I know that you're joking. And yet I still want to punch you in the fucking face.
No.
You know, like, you know what I mean? Like, it's like, that's the level of hatred for that movie. But honestly, so Rocky Horror, I have definitely a different view of it than you guys both do. The time warp is one of those things that just transcends everything. Like, I've done disability discos as a DJ, like with a laptop, you know, pressing play on Spotify, and there's some free advertising for Spotify that they don't need.
Other streaming services are available.
Yeah, they are. I'm on CoBuzz now, and it's pretty cool. Yeah, like, it's one of the most requested songs, the Time Warp. All the people know the dance moves. Even the ones in the wheelchairs are still, like, you know, taking a step to the right with their arm, you know, like there's like, everyone knows the moves. The pelvic thrust is a bit how you going, but anyway, long story short, this is the movie that I'm very confident that I saw when I was too young to see it, and the only thing that stuck with me was the time warp and this feeling of just being like, this is out there and weird. And so I was definitely younger than you, Violet. And it did not stick with me. To the point that the first time I can remember watching it in full was actually about a week ago, with Alex singing all the songs. She knew them pretty well. She's clearly seen it a bunch of times as well, and it means a lot to her. I've got to say, I was pretty underwhelmed. I was just like, oh, I didn't really like this much at all. I liked the start a bit, and like the fact that like Tim Curry is like at the wedding inexplicably and like turns around and like looks at the wall and stuff. I'm just like, what is going on? Like, this is like this is so weird. And I spotted him straight away because he's, you know, huge and in the background.
He's Tim Curry. Yeah.
He's Tim Curry. Yeah.
and I'm just like, this is odd, and I like odd. I can get on board with odd. Susan Sarandon, you know, like, wow, like I've forgotten that she was Janet. Like, this is how out of touch I was with this movie. And it didn't take long before my brain just went, oh God, does this hold up? You know, does this hold up? And I guess that's a question that I want to ask you guys. You both clearly love the movie and the stage show and all these things that go with it. Oh, actually, Andy, do you not?
Well, No, I do, but I object to a lot of things that you're saying, and I have some points.
Okay, interesting. Well, you know, please.
So, it's easy, I think, to look at it now through a lens of, what are we, 50 years later?
Yeah.
It's easy, I think, to say that it doesn't necessarily hold up, but it's worth remembering that it predates transgender as a label. Like, it's older than that. it's celebrating the gender nonconformity more so than it does any kind of rights. And I was listening recently to Tim Curry's memoir, which I urge anybody to read, because I listened to it, and obviously post the stroke that he had in 2012, shout out to him for doing that, because to read the whole book as an audiobook, he did a very, very good job. And he kind of kept his own personal life off the table, because at the start he said, "It's none of your fucking business," which I quite like. But I think what Rocky Horror, what Tim Curry actually says is that to him, to Frank, he's not trans. He's not a cross-dresser. He's not any different, because that's how they dress in transsexual Transylvania. So what he's wearing, he said the one piece of advice he ever gives anyone if they're playing Frank is that what he's wearing is just normal to him. Whereas to us as an audience, and as us now as an audience 50 years later, it feels like it's saying something that it probably wasn't intending to. It's more camp representation than it is trans representation.
Oh, yes.
Interesting.
It's 1,000% camp.
Like, as I say in the intro, there is a distinction, particularly nowadays. Like, he calls himself a sweet transvestite from transsexual Transylvania in one of the songs, right? And there is a distinction. Transvestite is an outdated term. It more or less means cross-dresser, right? And even, like, allowing for what Tim Curry has said about normality on their home planet, the home planet is called transsexual Transylvania, and he calls himself a transvestite. So those terms, I think, are still relevant. And he, you know, so yes, there is a distinction between transgender and cross-dresser, even in today's parlance. Like, I accept all that. So this is not strictly a trans movie, but I think I'm going to do, and I admit this in the intro, I'm going to do the most cisgender, white, straight man thing in the world and lump them together. because that's what we do. And because I think that I think there is the point. I think they are trying to communicate a point about trans representation. But Violet, I'd be curious to see where you fall on this one.
I would never say that I would argue with Tim Curry. If that was his thought process when he was creating this character, because it's also important to remember that he created this on stage in the first production. He brought it to the stage after London, to Los Angeles, to New York, to the movie. Mm-hmm. Like, he was Frankenfurter. The final word on it until other actors started to come in and put their own stamp on the character.
Isn't he?
I know. I mean, I've seen lots of people play Frank, so it's, you know, there are a lot. I've seen other people do it, but
yes,
like him in this movie, like, he is just a true force of nature. So for, you know, to think of it that way, if that is how he approached building this character, I would never argue with him about it. But I do think putting this movie and the show in the context of where it was for the queer community, in terms of how the Stonewall riots had been in New York City in 1969. So this is only 6 years later. It's 4 years after that for the stage show in London.
Yeah.
But it is a very present thought that these people are just trying to exist as themselves, the queer community. And that's what I see when I see this movie. I see just the desire to be out and be themselves. And yeah, to bring up camp, it's very true that that is like how all the costumes are, the acting. It's like so camp. It's very camp. And I had looked up an article on camp for, again, sorry to keep bringing it up, but the two are so entwined in my mind, but for Grey Gardens and for Rocky Horror. And It says in here, camp continues to be a vibrant, vital part of queer culture and artistic expression. It is a celebration of theatricality, artifice, and the right to be too much.
Mm.
So that's what you're seeing in this movie, in this show, in everything about it. It's too much.
Yeah.
Well, but it has the right to be.
Exactly. Mm. That I think that's what the celebration is of the story of the show, of the film. You exist and you exist loudly. And it's worth remembering, I think, that homosexuality was still criminalized in parts of the US and parts of the UK when it debuted. World,
frankly. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Trans people had virtually sort of no legal protections, and the media representation was just abhorrent if it existed at all.
Yeah.
So whilst Frank is a difficult character, I think, to sum up and discuss in the year 2025, the fact that the screenings and the show became a safe haven for people, the fact it created that space far outreaches any problems that are in the film for me.
Yeah, this is an interesting conversation. And obviously, like, you guys like the movie a lot more than I do. So as someone that's less versed with it, I'm pretty happy to take a back seat and to be convinced, you know, let you guys convince me. Mm-hmm. But I just want to put out there that, you know, as I discussed earlier, we aren't trans people, so far be it from us to describe how they should feel about a character or whatever. I guess I'm speaking strictly from personal experience, as we all are. And Andy, you make a good point there about the gravitation to this, that and that haven that people felt where the rest of society just simply was not a safe place, and maybe is becoming worse again. Maybe it's a weak word. It is becoming worse again. I guess I just want to point out that I don't have a problem with trans characters being the full spectrum of great people that are accurate representations and realistic representations of their part of society, part of culture, and also deeply fucking evil rapists and murderers. Like, I think we should have a full spectrum for all types of people, and that's great. But in a time where it was the only media representation that we had, especially in popular media, like, people talk about this being a cult film, there's a good argument that's the cult film. Like, it's the one. And
this or The Room.
Yeah, probably, right? Like, it's very in that conversation. So, Andy, we talked about Rain Man and Frame to Frame a couple of years ago now. And
one of my favorite episodes.
Yeah, it was great. I loved that episode too. And the idea that representation is interesting, it's an interesting conversation to have. And I think it's always alive and it changes with the times, because for autistic people, it was like, oh, like, people are more aware of autistic people, and maybe they watched that movie and thought, good, he's in the institution, that's the way it should be. Or maybe they watched that movie and thought, no, he really, like, grew as a person when he was out of the institution with his brother, and that's the way forward or whatever. But also there were a lot of harmful stereotypes about autistic people that persist to this day, because people understand autism as being a math genius and hitting your head at airports and screaming a lot. And that's just not – it's not exclusively the case for autistic people. And I wonder if that angle can be applied here a little bit, where we can sit there and say, look, yes, I'm so glad that it was a safe place for the trans community. I'm so glad that they still to this day as a community are latching onto this movie and loving it to bits. And also, is there space for a conversation around a time when all representation almost – to a complete 100% was villainous. You know what I mean? Like, it's nuanced, and we're probably not the right people to have the conversation, which is why I try and lean on trans voices for this, but I still wanted to put that out there, you know?
Yes, absolutely, we should have that conversation. And I do think that whilst it, you know, coming from where we are in terms of our identities, the fact of the matter is we can only ever speak from our experiences. Mm-hmm. But yeah. I think the idea of three cis white people speaking about these issues and this level of representation is still a very good thing, because if we weren't having conversations like this, then who would be outside of the existing incumbent community? And I think that it's important to have other voices as well as those within the community. And that is in no way to diminish the people from inside the community themselves.
Yeah, I agree with that. Like, it becomes less niche then, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. It's an example being, I had a discussion with somebody before, because on our email signatures in my day job, we have our pronouns.
He, and him, they, them, whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And somebody said, I have a very masculine name. Why do I need to put he, him afterwards? And I said, because it's not for you. It's normalizing it for the people that would be different, that would have something other than the anticipated version. So the fact that it's there is frankly just normalizing it for everybody. Mm-hmm. So I think that there is a level of taking it outside of the community in that way that I think helps.
Mm-hmm. Violet, you connect very deeply with this movie. You must have some thoughts around this.
I do. And I will say that I had kind of an idea how you felt about it after you watched it. And then when I watched it after having
that
idea.
You watched it through Beau eyes.
I did.
I'm so sorry. Yeah.
I did. No. It's not. Oh, please. I was still yelling things at my screen and singing along to every song. Like, it's fine. I still love it. Well, okay. Pencil me in for that, because we are going to get back to that, because I can tell that's really, that's under your skin and I have to explain it to you. Okay.
He's got my fucking neck.
I actually don't care that much.
Neck. So no, but I can tell. So pencil me in. We're put a pin in it. We're going back to that. But I was watching it, and I was, you know, and I mean, particularly, I know we're going to get to it, but there were definite scenes where I was like, oh, he hated this. Oh, I know this really, this really got him. And then that made me examine how I felt about it. And I was like, okay. And then, yeah, of course, like, you sit there and then you really do. You start going back through your memories of, like, did this strike me as odd when I saw it the first time? Did this strike me as odd when I was out doing this in my 20s? Did I ever have
Do you mean doing the show before? Or doing what was shown in the actual?
No, like watching the movie and how, like, these scenes didn't hit me the way that I know they hit Beau when he watched them. That, I think, isn't an... So, and also, you two knowing everything about me, why was that okay for me? Because Frank does do some pretty messed up stuff.
Yeah.
So why was that okay for me? Why didn't that bother me? I really don't really have an answer for you, but I definitely watched this with different eyes this time. I still love it. I still enjoyed every second of it, but I totally know all of the things that made you go, wait a second.
Mm-hmm. There's no question whatsoever that Frank and Ferda particularly is a very problematic character. Like baseline, everyone agrees with that. And doesn't matter whether it's us three or, you know, trans writers on the internet who love this movie and love the character of Frank and Ferda, they still acknowledge that there's some really problematic stuff. Mm-hmm. I want to just throw a thought experiment out there for you. You said you watched it through my eyes. Now, for those that might be new to the show, welcome.
You picked a hell of an episode.
Yeah. I'm known as extremely progressive. And that comes across in a lot of my reviews, right? If I was a Republican, right, like a hardcore right-wing lunatic, and I was watching this movie for the first time, I would also get encouragement for my views out of this thing. Like what are the Republicans worried about when it comes to trans people? They're worried about them indoctrinating the kids, mm-hmm. you know, and making them turn all gay and trans, and it's really bad and dangerous. And guess what? Guess what Frankenfurter does? He literally forces people to become cross-dressers and to dress and sing and dance a certain way because he forced them to with some sort of weird brainwashy statue vibe thing they had going on. And a Republican person would sit there and watch that and be like, see? You know? So I guess, yeah, like baseline, he's problematic for sure. And there's some really dark stuff in this thing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Frank is a character I think is fascinating for psychological unpicking because mm-hmm. he is magnetic and powerful, yet deceitful and manipulative, and he is absolutely villain-coded, 100%.
Yes.
That's even taken out of the question, the issue of consent, which I'm sure we're going to come to. I'm sure that was the main
scene. That was like the first time that I went, whoa.
Yeah. No, I knew it.
Yeah. But Frank as a character, I think he's extremely three-dimensional because there are a lot of things to begin to unpick in there. And this may just be through listening to Tim Curry's memoirs, which... Mm. Obviously, he speaks a lot about that character and he speaks a lot about the psyche of that character. And I think it would be absolutely rife for somebody to want to try and unpick.
Like, I'm very, very keen to get you guys talking about how great this movie is. And I want to promise the listeners that we are going to do that. And also, by the way, if you want to hear Ian Buckley's thoughts, his thoughts are available on Real Talk at the Film Stories Podcast Network with Sam Stokes. So if you want to hear Ian Buckley's thoughts and Sam's, please go over to Real Talk and check them out. Now, we've mentioned the whole consent thing. That's like very obviously very fucked. That whole bit is obviously fucked.
I know it's probably a spicy take to say that sexual assault is a bad thing.
Yes. And I think it is kind of played for laughs.
Yes.
It's totally. And like, oh, look 70s. How seductive he is, and like, oh, you like it, or whatever he says, you know. And it's
wait,
like,
where's he from?
Transsexual Transylvania.
I meant your accent.
Oh, I couldn't even begin to do a David Bowie tinged Tim Curry voice. I couldn't even begin.
So just very quickly before we circle back to the serious element, that voice came because he overheard the voice of a woman whilst he was on the bus. And he put that together with Queen Elizabeth II's voice, and marrying those together, he just went, that's Frank.
Yep.
No one can deny how good Tim Curry is in this movie. Violet, I just saw a glimpse of your notebook. I want thoughts.
Oh? I'm trying to get it where I can read it.
Yeah, so so basically,
Violet's gone atmospheric with the lighting. That's the problem here.
Yeah, I know.
So if I can move shortcomings forward, because we sort of organically got there, and we will talk about what's great afterwards. Please, audience, be rest assured that Beau will shut up in a sec. But
we celebrate until all then, voices, even dissenters.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, and I am dissenting, that's for sure. Look, for me, as I said, I was pretty into it. Like, you know, the Brad and Janet song was fun, and the whole setup is just kooky and absurd. The Time Warp's a classic. Frank's introduction song, wow, like what a showstopper. And then like it gets a bit weird, but I'm like, okay, I'm sort of along with this. And then Meatloaf happens and I'm like, what the fuck am I watching? And I think that's kind of the point. And yes. then the sexual assaults, plural, happen. Correct. And then there's also the whole thing about consent with like a 7-hour-old being, you know, that's a whole thing too. But yeah, whatever. That's like we did that with Poor Things and we're doing it again here, and it's weird. It's certainly a gray area at best. And I guess it it derailed the movie for me. And even where I really, really loved Fanfare / Don't Dream It, I loved that whole sequence. Like him sitting there in that floaty in the pool, just singing Don't Dream It, Be It repeatedly mm-hmm. was magic. Like there are great elements of this thing, but it derailed it because I was really stuck on the whole consent thing. Like it really mm-hmm. got to me. So via how do you said you watched it through my eyes a little bit, but you also yeah. have your own nostalgia. How do you reconcile these differences? You know, because that's it's a tough beat.
Yeah. Well, as I've said, I've seen this so many times, and seeing it, imagining you, because I thought, I didn't know you had seen it when you were younger. I thought when you watched it, like in your house this week, was the first time you had ever seen this.
It might and be in full. Yeah.
Yes. I could imagine your reaction to Frank entering Janet's room and entering Brad's room dressed as the others.
Yeah.
And using it the same dialogue with both of them. Mm-hmm. The consent is iffy. You are led to believe by what they say that they are into it, but they're surprised at first in a way. And I don't want to make it sound like I'm making an excuse for it, because I do think, especially seeing it this time, it's definitely seeded that both Brad and Janet are looking at Frank and thinking, oh, okay, like mm-hmm. I could be down with this. I mean, Janet, even from the beginning, is like, oh no, I don't want to be here. I don't like muscles. Before she even goes to the bedroom, she's like, oh, maybe I do like muscles. Like, they are that he enters the room under really terrible pretenses. That mm-hmm. shouldn't be there. That sucks. But I do think Janet wants what happens and Brad wants what happens. So it starts off bad, but I think they are learning through the moment to open themselves up to the experience is, I think, what happens. I am okay. not sure if that's right, but that's what I saw.
Does that sound right to you, Andy?
Yeah, that as a reading makes sense to me.
Yeah, it does to me actually as well.
They are, it's certainly an awakening within both of them. That doesn't excuse the start.
No.
But yeah, I will go with that.
Okay, interesting. So see, coming around a little bit, see? Mm-hmm. Like it's happening, we're getting there. Let's talk positive, right? Like I'm gathering as much that you guys both think this is great.
Oh, yeah. I think it's great, but I am carrying years of memories and good times and doing the time warp a million times and everything else with me. I think it's clever. I think it's fun. I think that it means a lot to a lot of people, and it's carrying 50 years worth of memories for people. And I think that the positives far outweigh the negatives.
I agree with that. I think it's weird. It's deliberately weird. And that is alienating. I wouldn't wholeheartedly like recommend this to somebody without getting to know them first. Whereas something like Back to the Future, something else we've covered this year, everyone should watch Back to the Future.
Yes. Before Sunrise or whatever. Like.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Maybe to a lesser extent, but yes, Back to the Future. Jean Dielman, right.
Yeah, well, I still can't talk to that. I just haven't had a spare 4 hours this year to watch someone do chores.
Isn't that a normal Saturday for you, watching Laura? No.
I think you've got the you dynamics lazy, in our house very, you, very wrong.
You lazy sod. No, okay. Mm. I kid.
Rocky Horror is rebellious. It's freeing. It's created an entire community. I think that its greatness isn't just about what is on screen. I think that it's greatness lies in the permission to exist loudly and the community that it's created. But it is also, for me, fun. unapologetically fun.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that you would wait to get to know someone really well before recommending it to them. Now, you know my thoughts about the film as it stands. You both know me pretty well before I had seen it. Would you have recommended it to me?
Yes, because we could have this discussion.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. That's the answer.
but you would have known that I would have had reservations about it?
Yeah.
Especially watching it being like,
oh yeah.
Oh. Oh, that's yeah. Ooh, 7 hours old. Interesting.
But I will say, seeing it without a big audience, seeing it without people doing the call out, seeing it without people dressed up, seeing it
have
as
you
not
even
being
really
a part of that communal experience, you haven't really experienced it. Really.
I think I would hate that.
And
honestly, like yeah. I went to Stop Making Sense, the Talking Heads concert movie, and I went to it last year, and I was sitting there in a cinema and people were up and they were singing almost as loud as David Byrne was, and I was just thinking, shut the fuck up. Shut the fuck up. Let David Byrne, a world-class musician and a great, do his thing at the peak of his powers. What the fuck are you doing? Let Demi's directorial choices shine through here. Let that happen. So no, I would have been like a proper curmudgeon at the Taylor Swift Eras tour, not just because of my views of Taylor Swift, but because everyone's singing and dancing and having a great time, and I'm just like crossing my arms being like, this is shit, I hate this. So I actually think that would make the film worse for me, believe it or not.
Normally I am Beau. Very often I am, but like I went to see Joseph's Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat and I had somebody sat in front of me. This is the show. I had somebody sat in front of me singing through the whole thing.
No.
And it pissed me off.
It should.
I had that with Wicked as well. Yeah.
What, the show?
The show, yeah. My first experience of it. And like she apologized first thing. She was like, oh, don't mind me, I'm a bit of a singer. And I'm like, okay.
No.
And she did sing a bit, but it wasn't too bad.
The worst I ever did was I mouthed every single word of Hamilton, but that's different. Because I wasn't making noise.
So I've
been to see Rocky Horror on stage. I've also experienced The Room in a cinema. And both are comparable because people shout things at the screen, people throw things. And it's kind of a different rule. It's kind of okay in those scenarios. And normally, like, even if I went to see like Six in the cinema, if people were singing to that, I'd very much be like you, Beau. But in the right environment, of which I think Rocky Horror is, I'm on board with it. I'm fine with it.
Well, fair enough. It sounds like, Violet, you're very on board with it.
Oh, it's so much fun.
It's interesting that you make the comparison to The Room, right? Because you're right. There is a similar level of cult following. Mm-hmm. But I think the vast majority of people follow Rocky Horror Picture Show to that level because they love it so much. And I feel like the vast majority of people with The Room follow it to that level because it's so abhorrently shit. it is appalling. And I find that an interesting dynamic, how it's like the yin and yang of the cult world.
I actually think that it's because people both films create that sense of community. They create that safe space to be strange, different,
and obnoxious and loud.
If you want to use those words, then sure. But
I will, yeah.
But it's the fact that there is, you can, I would enjoy that as an experience in both films equally. And that's irrespective of the quality of what's on screen. The difference, I think, is that you're laughing with Rocky Horror, whereas you're laughing at The Room.
At The Room, yeah.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
True.
Okay. Violet, what makes it great then? Is it?
Well,
as a film specifically as well, like technically,
oh, yeah.
What's on the screen, I guess.
as a film specifically, I have three things written down. And number one is Tim Curry's performance.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
He is outrageous. Yes. He's like, I've loved him my entire life. He is Rooster from Annie. He's, you know, Muppet Treasure Island. He is Frankenfurter. He is just,
Pennywise.
He is Clue, which you can edit this out, Bo, but I looked up, oh my God, when did we get to do Clue? When was that released? 85.
Oh.
Running out of time. We can't do it. There's no way. There's too much
Sorry,
stuff going
that
on.
Is,
but yeah,
yes.
No, there's no way. There's no time. Clue. He's unbelievable. He's one of my favorite people on the face of the planet, and he is just unreal in this
Spam-a-lot
movie.
Spamalot as well. That's
Spamalot too. Yeah.
Is that agreement across the board here, Andy, that Tim Curry is like just outrageously good in this film?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, are you on board with that?
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
There's no question about it. Like, for a feature film debut, just quietly, what the
yeah.
hell?
Oh, yeah.
I know that he brought it from the stage, but still that screen presence, you know,
oh,
flirting with
so
the camera.
So charismatic.
Yeah.
So charismatic.
So yes, totally agree with your first point.
Yep. Second point is the music. I love the music. I really do. I love the songs. They're all very silly. We've somewhat mentioned Richard O'Brien, but, you know, the weird guy writing the show based on, you know, B-movies and camp and 50s rock and roll. Mm. And it's fun and just like they're all good. All the songs are good. It's one of those shows where you watch it and the song starts and you're like, oh, I love this one.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I love this one. Oh, this is another good song. Like every song is good. They're all good.
Yes.
And yeah, the third thing I have written down is the camp of it all. Like it's just camp perfection.
Yes. So to the British audience among us, if we're bringing up Richard O'Brien, I'd be remiss to not say about The Crystal Maze. So that was where
I read about that today.
So my first exposure to Richard O'Brien was we had a game show wherein there were different zones of a puzzle room, and you had like a few different people on that were a team together, and you would send someone in to try and get the crystal, with the main aim being you get more time in the crystal dome at the end to collect cash, right? Richard O'Brien was the host, and it was amazing. It was so good. It was like, that is what you watch on a Saturday evening. It, like, the Crystal Maze was fantastic. So then when he left, obviously there was a downgrade, but that was the first time I'd ever come across Richard O'Brien. So always he is the guy from The Crystal Maze. Even when he's Riff Raff, he's the guy from The Crystal Maze.
Mm-hmm.
But then when I found out about him writing this, because I didn't know, it sort of chimes. Like a lot of the stuff from The Crystal Maze, a lot of the atmosphere, it was obviously watered down for a family-friendly Saturday night audience.
I imagine so, yeah.
You'd hope so.
Yeah.
But, I think a lot of his personality is on the screen, mm-hmm. for better or for worse. And there is the real love of the 50s sci-fi B-movies that comes through even right in the first song. I just think that the way he wrote it is fantastic.
Yeah, it's eye-catching, isn't it? That for Science Fiction, I think it's called, that opening song,
yeah.
with the
Science
lips.
Science Fiction double feature.
Yep.
Double feature, yeah. And eye-catching. The Brad and Janet song is great, and you know, Time Warp's transcended, as I mentioned. So many of the songs are great. I didn't love all of them the same way you do, Violet. I found Meatloaf's whole bit ridiculous, it was ridiculous by design.
It is ridiculous,
but just in a way that I think I was just really caught off guard. Like I was just like, what the hell? Because honestly, like the last thing you see is like him motorcycling down the wall, and it looks like it's going to crush Rocky and Frankenfurter.
Mm-hmm.
And then he just bursts through with his motorcycle singing the way Meatloaf does, which is absurdly big. Yep. And then I'm just like, hang on, did these characters just die? Like, what the hell? Like, what happened? And then he starts dry humping Columbia. And then, yep. and then you're just like, and then he gets murdered with an axe. And I'm just like, what? And like, to be honest, I couldn't tell you a single thing about that song. Couldn't tell you a single thing about it because I was just like, what is going on? I don't even know if it's good or bad. But there were some songs that didn't work for me, I guess. Andy, you're champing at the bit there.
Yes. So you keep sort of saying that you don't know what Eddie brings to the whole thing. And mm-hmm. he is unrestrained energy. And he is rebellion, and he is everything that Frank can't control. Mm-hmm. So what Frank does, he can't dominate Eddie, so he kills him.
Yes.
And that is away first, right?
Yeah. So that is what Eddie is needed. We need that at that point, because that's when Frank turns somewhat. Because up to that point, we've been almost nothing but celebratory of Frank. And then there's this other side. There is an edge and a danger to this character.
Mm. Yes.
But also, you know, you needed Meatloaf's voice. Like, he comes into the film like a bat out of hell, sings the hell out of Hot Patootie, and then goes away for a little bit.
Yes, exactly.
Goes away for a little bit. He gets obliterated with an axe.
Yeah, yeah. And then that happened, yes.
And then dinner.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, he had dinner with a friend.
Uh-huh. It's a tender subject. Without Eddie, we don't get Dr. Scott there either. So, yeah.
Is that a loss?
Well, I mean, for the plot, yeah.
the plot needs it.
What do you think the plot needs him there.
What's Dr. Scott even doing? Like, seriously, honestly, this is me being quite genuine.
Okay.
I think from like that point onwards, most of the movie is a blank for me because I'm so lost. I'm just so like, what is going on? Okay, so he's like the friend, I guess, and he's there because he's the nephew, I guess, and they start eating his nephew, I guess, and then he's paraplegic, I guess, and then he's a genius, I guess, and then he's wearing fishnets, I guess, like and then he dies, I guess. I don't know, like, what happens? I don't get it.
Oh, so, they're not dead at the end, but yeah.
No, he's conservatives, right? He's the guy that's uncomfortable with the whole situation. He's confused by everything that's happening. He's nervous mm-hmm. about the transgressions that are going on. His
nephew was murdered, though, so of course he's uncomfortable.
But he's the audience surrogate for people that don't understand queerness and don't Correct. Understand what world that we are inhabiting. And I think that he is there by design to show the absurdity of straight gaze when there is fluidity and freedom in front of him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's a government agent hunting for UFOs, and the aliens in this movie are queer people. Mm-hmm. So...
Okay. So I missed the whole like government agent searching for UFOs. Yeah. I had no fucking idea. I thought it was like a rival scientist was the general vibe that I had for Dr. Scott.
That's kind of part of it, but right before when he shows up at the castle before they let him in, Frank turns on Brad and says, "Isn't he now part of your government hunting down UFOs?" And Brad's like, "I don't know, because Brad knows nothing."
Okay. Well, I do remember that. At that point, I just assumed that Frank Inferno was just talking shit because he was very clearly an unreliable character based on the deception in the raping scenes, just the general, I'm going to murder you because I don't like you, I can't control you, chasing Rocky the way he does, around like the room and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like... I just didn't trust Frankenfurter when Frankenfurter said like literally anything. So I guess that's where I fell short on that one. Okay. I don't even know where to proceed with this because I want to go back to
Violet explaining where the Janet slut.
Oh, stuff comes okay.
From. Yeah, go
sure.
on.
Sure. Well, not that I have to explain where it comes from.
It's less of an issue for me than you might think.
Okay. All right. No, I mean, it is awful, but also you have to, as we said before, like putting the movie and also the audience for the movie, the cult, if we say, for the movie in the proper context. These are queer people. They are probably, you know, gay men, lesbians. They have a secret language that you might not know if you are not queer. When I am hanging out with my queer friends, I am addressed very differently than how I am addressed when I am hanging out with you two. It would not be strange for me to be out and have it be like, oh my God, what are you wearing, you slut? Like, that's like, you look amazing. That's normal. That's how I would expect to be greeted. So if you put it in that context, a bunch of queer people yelling slut at the screen is a strange compliment.
One of us, that kind of vibe. It like, is kind of like the C word down here in Australia, right? Like it's still a gross enough word that I still have to say C word around certain people and certain audiences.
Yet you text me and call it to me all the time.
Because it's a term of endearment. It's a term of endearment. It's also a term of derision, which I use sometimes. It's very confusing and very nuanced, and I imagine it's the same in the queer community with different coded words.
Correct. Yes. I think that it comes more from that than it comes from, you know, the way that we would think of it as slut shaming. Something like that. Yeah. I don't think that they are not slut shaming Janet. They love to see Janet becoming who she is over the course of this movie, discovering her sexuality and becoming positive about it and things like that. Like, her verse in the floor show is just like, this is me now and everyone's just going to have to deal with it. And that is a celebration for the queer community. So they're not calling her a slut to make her feel bad. They're calling her a slut to say, good, you do you, slut, go for it.
No,
I am also underqualified to join this part of the conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, honestly, I didn't find that much issue with it. I sensed that it might have been in the spirit of celebration, but without knowing for sure. Can you guys hear a garbage truck pulling up, by the way? Side note.
No.
No.
This is not like a dementia test or like I'm having a stroke or something. There is a garbage truck. I just wanted to make sure that if it does come through on the audio, that the audience is aware that I live in an apartment with front facing towards the road and things are going to happen sometimes.
Yeah.
The garbage truck is coming.
Let's talk favorites.
I gave you an open goal.
What was it?
I needed So's Brad.
Oh my God, you did. That's one of the call outs. I know. Sorry. We've been teasing it all week. We have to eventually get to the biggest, most famous one if one of us is gonna say Antissa.
Patient.
Yeah.
Yeah, but we needed Bo to scream, say it in the middle.
The thing is, I like people talk about that being like a big moment, like Antissa, patient. But like to me, it's like, yeah, it's obviously anticipation that he's talking about. Like, I don't anticipate. Like, I'm not caught in the spell, you know. Like, it's not working on me. And you guys are more musical people than I am, just generally as a baseline. So there's that. But yeah. Even when I was vaguely liking the movie and parts of it, it wasn't like I was like, "Oh, he's gonna say it. He's gonna." Like, I wasn't the kind of person that was like, "Yeah, Barney, say Derry at the end of Legend." You know, like in How I Met Your Mother. Like, it was like that. So I was like, whatever. I can't even remember the say it bit.
Say it.
Let's talk favorites.
Favorites. Oh boy. Yep.
Let's talk favorites. Now, favorite song.
I love science fiction double feature.
Uh-huh.
Because it's so sin illiterate. Mm-hmm. It's so
yeah, that was fun.
To set this particular scene, I think that it is. I mean, it's just a great song on top of everything else, and it to get it to start this particular film, which is all in a completely different kind of world. It's very avant-garde representation in the film as well. So it's the lips of Patricia Quinn, who was originally supposed to sing the song, and she played Magenta, the servant in the film. And Riffraff's sister.
Yeah.
Yes. Sorry. There's more going on than you realize when you see the end. But it was actually Richard O'Brien that sang it in the film because it was just lip synced to give it that level of questionable gender androgyny. But I think that it is, it's a brilliant song. And if one song came on, I'd be like, oh, yes, it'd be that one. Either that or touch me.
Yeah, that song is awesome too.
Violet, what about you?
My favorite song is Over at the Frankenstein Place. I love that song. Yep. I love the harmonies. I love how it's giving a hug to like every Hammer horror movie that was ever made in this like very campy, silly, well, we're in a dark and stormy night kind of way. And I love Richard O'Brien coming in as Riff Raff, our first time that we see Riff Raff, because Riff Raff is actually my favorite character in Rocky Horror. So I love when he is in that window and he sings and he sounds so good. And then all the harmonies and the lightning. I love Over at the Frankenstein Place.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that none of us are picking Time Warp. And it's interesting that Time Warp, as I said, it's transcended anything to do with this movie, really. People know the Time Warp backwards without knowing what the Rocky Horror Picture Show even is. And it's fascinating, and like my favorite part of that song without question is Riff Raff when he's like, and I remember, you know, like he like goes like really into it. I'm just like, whoa, that's always great. But I think my favorite song is Fanfare, Don't Dream It. And I think maybe because thematically that was something that I connected to, like it's one of the only times I really connected with Frankenfurter, where he's sitting there talking about the dresses of Fay Wray and crying because that's what he wanted to wear, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's interesting, coupled with the conversation about how Tim Curry was talking about how he's just dressing normally for his home planet. It's like, well, that doesn't make sense. But, I mean, apart from that, like, I think that song's really great. And Don't Dream It, Be It being like a, you know.
The anthem.
Yes. Yeah. That's
exactly.
Awesome.
You referenced that none of us picked the Time Warp. I very recently started rewatching Spaced for the first time in a long, long time. And I forgot that in the second episode, there is a moment where Simon Pegg's character and Jessica Stevenson's character, they are hosting a housewarming party and the Time Warp comes on. And Simon Pegg's character storms out and explains how much he hates the Time Warp because, quote, it is boil in the bag perversion for sexually repressed accountants.
Oh, no.
And it's like that seems played for laughs, right? And it's hilarious. Like, it's so funny to watch him and Nick Frost together shouting about the hatred of the Time Warp because it's a party staple.
Yeah, it is. Are you doing an Edgar Wright rewatch in preparation for The Running Man? Is that what's happening?
It was more after we did Shaun of the Dead on Friend to Friend.
Of course.
Oh, yes.
With Young Frankenstein. A great pairing. Mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to that episode. I haven't listened to it yet. Yeah, Violet, any thoughts about Time Warp? Because, like, yeah, it hasn't become, like, too big. You know how, like, you love a song until you hear it a million times and you're like, I'm kind of over that song. Is that where we're at?
No, never. No. It's like when that starts at a party or something, like I am there immediately. Like, it's great. Love the time warp.
Yeah, the pelvic thrust is going insane kind of vibes. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
It is. I remember.
Favorite character. You mentioned Riff Raff Violet.
I love Riff Raff, yes.
Why?
I have no real way to answer this question. I've just always loved Riff Raff. Like from the first viewing. And it's not to say that I don't love Tim Curry in this movie. We've already talked about it. I love Tim Curry in this movie. But if I really had to explain it, I love how just absolutely over it Riff Raff is the whole time. He just wants to go home. He's so done. He's done with Frank. He's just done with it. And when he finally is like, that's it. I've had it. I've had enough. We're done. We're going back. Enough with you. It's just so funny. I don't know. I think Riff Raff's hilarious.
And he kills Frankenfurter, no?
He does. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So what's the deal there? Like, why does that happen? I don't understand that.
He's had enough. He kills Frank because there's some unknown mission. They're there on a mission from their home planet. And Riff Raff accuses him of not finishing the mission. So him and Magenta are going to go back. And instead of taking him back, even though he sings a whole song about it, they murder him and then take the castle back because they're done.
Okay, yeah. I mean, again, I was pretty checked out by this point. Like, I still love fanfare, Don't Dream It, but yes. Like, I was pretty out, to be honest.
You're like, plot? What plot?
And that I've, you know, it's interesting to hear, like, particularly Andy, you've been saying things like, well, I mean, like, he represents conservatives, and like, yeah, mm-hmm. like, he represents rebellion. That's the whole thing, and that's something that Frankenfurter can't control. And I'm sitting there being like, interesting.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That all tracks. For some reason, I just completely blanked this shit because I'm watching like deer in headlights style, just being like, what is happening to me? It's kind of like, remember when Everything Everywhere All at Once was, it happened, people liked it, and then it was generating like a lot of buzz, and then it started generating like genuine like awards buzz, and then there started being backlash, and a lot of the backlash from people, mm-hmm. particularly in the Film Stories Network that I remember, were saying things like, oh, it's like too much, it's like Technicolor, da 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 da. To be honest, that's how I felt about this movie. I was just like, it was just like too much happening. Like I didn't have anything to grasp onto. I don't know if it was like a sensory overload or something. You're all making great points about why it's a great movie and what you like about it, but far out, I just couldn't.
But I think this is the benefit of multiple viewings, yeah. Right? Like, Violet, you've seen it more than anyone can count. I've seen it a handful of times. Mm-hmm. And also I've experienced it live. So coming with different readings to it versus watching it for possibly all the way through the first time. Mm-hmm. Like it's a difficult thing to try and sum up in that regard, because I get it. Like, I understand where you are. But I just think that the chaos of the whole thing is what makes it.
Well, to be honest, I tried to watch it again last night, and Alex was just like, she was not keen, and I think maybe I brought the vibe down a little bit last time we watched it.
So, no,
like, I didn't do it deliberately. I didn't, you know, trying to let people like their stuff or whatever. But like, I don't know, maybe she just wasn't in the mood. I don't know. We ended up playing Stardew Valley together instead, but it was an interesting thing to watch her say no to it, because she seemed to like it so much. It was like she was literally singing along to it.
Yep.
And not a bad voice, Alex, just quietly. not a bad voice. Certainly better than mine, dear listener. Andy, favorite character?
I mean, it's Frankenfurter, right? He is brought to life by just an exquisite performance. His physicality, the way he can walk and strut in stilettos is enviable for almost anybody. So to have that kind of ability to prowl and dominate space, and he really does command the film. So yes, I completely get Violet's point about Riff Raff just being over this shit.
Yes.
And I think Richard O'Brien very clearly knew what he looked like as well. Like, it's you can't Lent Richard O'Brien ugly. Couldn't have
yeah
well he couldn't have written himself Frank as a character because
no,
physically that doesn't make sense, but he is a perfect Riff Raff. So
I'd
go with Frank is the standout for me.
Interesting. I to be honest, I didn't like the movie.
You didn't have a favorite character.
Yeah.
So I'm interested. One more favorite I'll get from you. Favorite scene. Now, is it the same as your favorite song, or is it a little bit different? In my case, it is. I think the scene. Well, yes and no, actually, for me, because I think like the stage bit where the four statues come to life, I think was just like confusing and weird. And again, there's a lot of thematic stuff that I'm sure I'm missing, but like, I was just like, I was so out, hey. But then Frankenfurter takes the stage. You have that close up talking about Fay Wray, and then into the pool. And there's a really nice shot, you know, from above. Obviously, that's a great shot, bird's eye. But then there's also one sort of like floor level looking down into the pool off to the side of him, again, looking up still, singing. And there's something about that shot that made Frankenfurter seem really vulnerable at that time. And I don't know, like very alone in a weird kind of way. It wasn't this majestic top down, I'm on a stage. It was like alone in a pool. And I thought it was just a really interesting choice, a really well put together scene, a great performance from Tim Curry. So I think that is my favorite scene, as well as being my favorite song. Do your songs and scenes differ?
Yes.
For favorites?
Yes.
Go, yes. Violet.
Okay, you ready?
Yes.
Janet, Dr. Scott, Janet, Brad, Rocky. Janet, Dr. Scott, Janet, Brad, Rocky. Every single time. Every single time. I will laugh like crazy every single time.
So help me out here. So anytime that Janet is mentioned, people yell slut, right? Anytime that Brad is mentioned, it's asshole. So during that scene, are people just like yelling slut, asshole, slut, like just going for it? Or like,
I think for that one, from what I remember, everyone yelled the dialogue along with them.
Okay.
I feel like every time we do it, everybody is just yelling, you know, yelling what they're yelling. So
yeah, okay, that makes more sense. Good. Yeah, that's quite funny. Andy, favorite scene?
So I love the scene which Tim Curry called the most difficult to film. It's when he's creating Rocky and he's in the pod and he's doing the bits with the colors and getting all that, like the energy, the kinetic sense of transformation that's in the air, and harking back to a lot of the Hammer horrors and all of the Frankenstein of it all is there. And then for Rocky to emerge like a living sculpture, he is Adonis.
So beautiful, yeah.
Yes.
So to have that, I think it's the most visually cinematic moment of the film. It wasn't quite that way on stage, but in the film, I think it is my favorite scene.
All right. Is there anything else burning in pockets before we get to MVP?
I have some trivia.
Oh, yeah, of course. Sorry. I'm so sorry. Yeah.
I
already gave mine, so I kind of skipped the behind the scenes trivia. But
I know you love trivia.
Yeah, I do. I'm a big trivia guy. In fact, let me do a game for you, because I haven't actually looked up that much of it. So how many do you have written down?
I have one that dovetails very nicely with Andy's favorite scene. He probably already knows it, but it doesn't matter. I'm going to say it anyway.
Okay.
Then I have another one.
Okay. So, Andy, do you have two?
I have what I can remember from Tim Curry's book. I didn't. I didn't. Somewhere in the middle of Violet and Ian is kind of where my prep level is.
Okay. Because I was going to suggest, like, whoever can impress me with the best fact wins. But maybe we'll set that up for a future episode where we actually do prep.
I can do that. I can do. I've got one.
All right, two each then. Two each if you want. You can have two shots at trying to impress me the most with the best fact about Rocky Horror Picture Show. Being the lady, do you want Andy to go first or do you want to take the first hit up?
I'll go first.
Okay,
I'll go first. On. So, yeah, the film was shot at Oakley Court, which is where a lot of the Hammer Horror films were. So there's that built-in, like, cult classic-ness of also those movies and then this movie. And the actual props for Rocky's birth, the tank and the dummy, were props from Revenge of Frankenstein from the Hammer Horror film.
Oh, okay. Okay. Good start. A strong start.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Andy, reply. What's a fact that you can give me?
Mine is far less to do with the film itself. But when Tim Curry was living in New York City, he attempted to attend a midnight screening of the Rocky Horror Picture Show, only to get turned away because they refused to believe he was Tim Curry.
It's very New York.
That reminds me of, oh God, I can't even remember what it was. It was like someone turning up to a lookalike contest and coming third, and that was like the same.
Charlie Chaplin.
That was it. Yeah. He came third at his own lookalike contest or something. All right. That's
strong. Timothy Chalamet do that recently?
Timothy Chalamet did show up to his lookalike contest.
Yeah. He probably won it though, right? Because, I mean, I don't know. People aren't weird anymore. Okay.
People are more weird now, but
that's probably true. We're talking about a movie from 1975 that is maybe the most weird shit I've ever seen in my life.
Yep.
But okay, let's go with your second one, Vi.
So my second one is about Sue Blaine, who is the costume designer.
Mm-hmm.
So she did the most costume designer thing in the world, and I say this as someone who is currently implementing a costume design.
They made costumes.
She had previously worked with Tim Curry in a play where she had put him in a corset. So she called up that theater and got the corset because she didn't want to do the work again. And girl, I feel you.
Yeah. I have no need to reinvent the wheel. A lot of respect to Sue Blaine, by the way. Great costumes in this thing. More on that in a second. Andy, your second to try and take the win.
Yeah. Okay. Meatloaf can't ride a motorcycle.
What?
He was riding a wheelchair with handlebars and a windshield.
Oh, God.
Was he really?
Yeah.
That's funny.
Was there a stunt double for the motorcycle bits, or am I just like imagining things?
Yeah, okay. Must have been. Oh, man.
Well, I can't ride a motorcycle either, so that's that tracks. So, okay. But it's quite...
The magic of movies.
Is the album cover of Bat Out of Hell also on a motorbike?
Yep.
Yeah, but
like a Bat Out of Hell?
But it's the bat, I think. It's not him.
And also, you know how photography works in that it's not moving?
I know, I get that, but I just like there's so much iconography around. Like, fuck you. Like, there's so much iconography around.
Maybe he learned.
Like, you know, like you guys have always seen me wearing glasses, and it's like, actually, he doesn't have a vision impairment. You know, like it would be like that level of weird, you know, like it's like.
You do, you dude.
Okay. Now to pick a favorite, I'm sorry, Vi, but I think that Meatloaf has just blown my brain there. Sorry.
No, that was a good win. I didn't know that either. So, yeah.
Shout out to Tim Curry's autobiography.
Yeah, this could be fun for future episodes, by the way. I think the host having to pick a winner could be fun.
I like that.
Okay, all right. So let's talk about MVPs.
I'm good.
All trivia. Yep, all good. Okay. MVPs. We've spoken a lot about different people here. I do want to just very briefly touch on something about Richard O'Brien, who is the creator of all these songs and everything, right? So Richard O'Brien is a trans person. Like Richard O'Brien, I believe still goes with he, him pronouns, but identifies as like 70% male, 30% female, whatever that means to him. And is also a TERF, saying that trans women can never be natural women. So it's created a lot of tension around this film because there are a lot of trans people that are like, well, you know, I there's positives, there's negatives, there's problematic elements, there's this, and then there's that. And it's like, oh man, like this person doesn't even respect me. And of all people that should, like, you know, like people have found identity in this movie and then being betrayed by the creator of it, you know, there's a tension there that's hard to reconcile. So I just want to touch on that. I mentioned it very briefly in the intro that New Zealand did want him and there's a whole thing there, but that was a bit tongue in cheek. But yeah, Richard O'Brien, a problematic character in and around this movie, but it's hard to deny his impact as Riff Raff, as the creator of these songs that are objectively pretty good, I think, as a bare minimum, and then quite great in certain parts. Tim Curry, lights out performance, like absolute lights out performance from Tim Curry. And then there's, you know, there's other technical elements that I think are pretty strong. I think Sue Blaine's costumes is strong work. I understand a lot of that was for the stage, but still. Cinematographer, I think some of the choices, as I mentioned earlier, Peter Schusitzky, that's a hard name to say. They also shot Eastern Promises, by the way, later on in his career. I think some great work there. I'm sure there's other people that I'm forgetting. Jim Sharman, the director, I'm sure gets a nod from certain people. Andy, we'll go with you first. Who's your MVP?
It's Richard O'Brien. For all the problematic elements and separating the creator from the creation, I mentioned earlier when discussing sort of what he did with the Crystal Maze and stuff. This film and show feels like it's within his image. It feels like we're playing in his brain, for better or worse. And it's interesting that there are problematic elements in there, but there's also a whole lot of strange, weird, kooky fun. And I think that when you've put together a work that is as inclusive as Rocky Horror, then the person behind it kind of doesn't matter as much because the work speaks for itself.
Interesting. I can definitely see it from a... I mean, technically, the film doesn't work at all without the songs and being put together. And you're right, it does have like a fever dream quality to it. Like it is someone's like stream of like some of it genuinely feels like stream of consciousness. Like just like here's a fucking idea, and then just film it. Like you know what I mean?
Like, and then later on, you'll look at us two and say, "What did that mean?"
Yeah,
it's like when you read Nietzsche. You go like, "I'll read Nietzsche, and then I'll read a book to say what the fuck Nietzsche was saying."
What do you mean the fucking child is the best one? What do you mean, Nietzsche? Anyway, there's one for the philosophy nerds. Since when is a child above a fucking lion, Nietzsche? Anyway, go on. Sorry. So Vi, do you agree that it is Richard O'Brien or do you have a different MVP?
I had Richard O'Brien written down. And I mean, basically for all the reasons that Andy said, like we don't have the movie without the show. He created the show. He is Riff Raff. He wrote all the songs. It was really, really disappointing to read that fact when I was doing my research. I was really upset about it. Had to take a second to just really kind of think about it. But I do agree with Andy. I think that the work is bigger than its creator now.
Yeah. And I want to mention, because Andy earlier in the episode mentioned that we can only really see the the world from our purview. And I think sometimes I am guilty of being someone that will stand up and be offended on behalf of communities when it's not necessarily my place to be. So it's like a weird balance of trying to find like empathy and holding space for criticizing things that I think are troublesome for those communities and using my privilege to platform and lift those communities up, but also not be offended on their behalf. And I will just point out that there are people in that community, the trans community, that are deeply hurt by Richard O'Brien's stuff. So yes. It's, you know, there is, yeah, it's a real balance. Honestly, he wasn't my MVP anyway. And it's a very strong argument from both of you. Before I even read the stuff about Richard O'Brien, which was after the film, to be clear, after I watched the film, I thought the MVP was super obvious. I think it's Sue Blaine, the costume designer, for putting Susan Sarandon in those outfits. For me, that was I take that as a personal favor. That no, I was obviously jest. I apologize.
You pervert.
Slut.
I obviously jest. That went down like a lead balloon.
No.
But no. For me the MVP is super, it's genuinely super obvious. I think it's Tim Curry. I think I read something. As a cinephile, you get to a point in your film watching life where you start to consider best of all time type of conversations, and whether you want to make a list or rank it or whatever, like I have done that sort of stuff, and I find comfort in that. I know that you don't. Per my episodes with Den of 10 with Sam Stokes of the Film Stories Network, I love a list. So always thinking about the best performances of all time, you know. And I saw someone say this might be the greatest performance of all time, and I initially rejected it straight away. And then I thought about it, and I thought, I think for me this film would be completely fucking unwatchable if it wasn't for him. Now, the songs, I like some of them or whatever, but like I found it just too much. It was like too much going on, and I did not enjoy myself very much at all. But I, and yes, problematic character for sure, but absolutely shot the lights out. It's an enormous performance from Tim Curry. I think, you know, for a first film performance, feature film performance, it is outrageously good. I don't think it's the greatest film performance ever, but I think if someone said that, it's not a crazy thing to say. And I think that holds some weight.
I don't think it's Tim Curry's best performance. Mm. I think that's Clue.
Yeah.
So
I actually would agree with that. Yeah.
In that film, he has to hold all of those threads together, and on top of delivering ridiculous dialogue and exposition and making it interesting, and it's like I just think that the job in Clue, I think is possibly more impressive, and that is not to do down the job he does in Rocky Horror.
Yeah, I mean I would agree with you. It's definitely Clue is better than Frankenfooter, and because he's juggling all of those other personalities. Like everyone else in that movie is like a giant. So
yes,
interesting. I haven't seen Clue, so.
Well, there's also Scary Movie 2.
Oh God, Home Alone 2, Lost in New York.
God,
yeah.
I love him as Pennywise. I think he's great.
Oh God,
as Pennywise.
He's so scary as Pennywise. Terrifying, you know,
like, unhinged, kind of like Skarsgård was a different Pennywise in the in the recent It's, right? I think Skarsgård was scarier, but I think there was like an unhingedness to Curry that
there was a gravity to his Pennywise. Mm-hmm. I think that it was more grounded in reality in a way that I felt Skarsgård's kind of wasn't, because it was more CGI led, it was more effects led, whereas Pennywise was all Tim Curry. Yeah,
he's so charismatic.
He's a brilliant actor.
Yes.
And I think that he only began to get his due later on. And, mm-hmm. you know, subsequently, he can't put those kind of kinetic performances together.
Yeah.
Number one, because, you know, he's no spring chicken at the ripe old age of 79, but also... Mm-hmm. You know, like I said, post-stroke, he's bound to a wheelchair. Like, I'd have loved to have seen him in Amadeus. That would have been one of the great.
That is my whenever anybody, because we're theater people, we're weird. We have a question we'd like to ask each other. If you could go back in time and see one performance, Amadeus, with Tim Curry, with Ian as McKellen, Mozart. With... He was Mozart on Broadway.
Oh, yeah,
so Tim Curry, Ian McKellen, and Jane Seymour. That was the Broadway cast of Amadeus.
Mm-hmm.
That's my answer.
Arguably better than the film cast.
It is better than the film. I mean, I love the film, but...
Yeah, me too.
But, oh my God, can you imagine? Think about how he's strutting around in Rocky Horror and just imagine that as Mozart. That energy
was good in a corset.
As Mozart. Yeah. He would have been, that's what I need. That's what I would travel back in time to see.
Against McKellen, Salieri as well.
Yes.
Yeah.
They were up against each other for best actor at the Tonys and McKellen won.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That sounds familiar to the film. Salieri wins twice. Yeah. Interesting. That kind of reminded me. So part of the reason why Richard O'Brien's a great choice and Tim Curry's a great choice is that if Rocky Horror didn't exist and you cast it now and in a film, I struggle to think of someone that could have done what Tim Curry did. Mm-hmm. And obviously, I mean, like the entire thing came out of Richard O'Brien's brain. So where is that coming from if not from him? Right. So they are two amazing, I think, amazing choices for MVP because it's just so hard to replicate what they contribute. You can contribute fishnet costumes or whatever, but
I think now if you were to cast it, you could have someone who's sort of very intense and eerie and charismatic with a darker edge. Maybe a Rami Malek kind of.
I knew it.
Oh man!
I was shaking my head already. You saw me. Oh. I could see you breaking. I knew it. Yeah, go on. Oh. Toby Maguire as well. Why not?
Oh no! You
know? Yeah.
No, I think genuinely, I think they could be somebody like a Janelle Monáe.
Ooh.
Oh, to play it like, yeah, okay, just like mix.
I think
the gender
Frank
up a
could then be
whatever.
A really bold and gender fluid version. I think that
Laverne Cox was Frank in the TV one. So there's, you know, that you can cast it. Yeah, there's precedent.
And that sort of shifted the character in a more trans direction, didn't it? Like obviously Laverne Cox being a trans woman, but the character itself changed a little bit as well with that change. So, I mean, why not? God. Right? You could throw it up to be like a black woman. Why not?
And like, think of the voice. Think of the songs.
Oh, yeah, Janelle, my God. Yeah. Like, the bi panic that you just put me in, I can't even finish this right now. Oh, my God.
I trust you've seen her latest album cover from a couple of years ago.
Please, I can't talk about it.
But, guys, let's call it. Like we've been here for an hour and a half talking about how much you guys particularly love Rocky Horror Picture Show. To be honest, you guys have talked me around a little bit.
Okay,
about
hooray!
Yeah, sorry. Hang on, sorry. I'm like, sorry. Yeah,
I didn't even get a chance to bring up Sabrina Carpenter and Coleman Domingo. I'm just kidding. Don't worry about it.
I don't even understand that reference.
Her video for Tears is a Rocky Horror tribute, and Coleman Domingo is Frankenfutter.
I've seen... Hang on. No, I haven't seen that one.
I'll send you.
Is that new? Is that brand new?
Yeah, that's the single off of Man's Best Friend, so it came out fairly recently, before Halloween. So I loved her take on it. She's all dressed up like Janet, and then she's all dressed up like Janet.
If it helps, the film as a whole is about an hour and 40 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we've done this. We've done it.
Yep.
We haven't even done minute by minute, like Roger Ebert style, where it's like, oh okay, my God. Freeze there. What is the director trying to say? Because, like, you know, like you'll be like, you know, it'll be a shot of like Meatloaf dry humping little Nell on the ground, and then you'll be like, okay, freeze. What is the director trying to say here? So I don't know, man. I think the writer and the director were like on acid or something. There's a lot going on. Anyway. Yep.
So what happens when you let crazy theater people in? Okay.
Guys, we've been we have gone long in the tooth, as we make mention too. I will just mention very quickly that you guys are doing other things as well, particularly on the Film Stories Podcast Network. So, Andy, how's Frame to Frame going?
We are pretty much planned for the year at this point. We know the direction in which we're going. We'd actually recorded an episode earlier on in the year that I'd forgotten about. So that needs editing and putting out.
Love that.
Because it knocked out my number in sequence. So... That is a thing. But let's just say we'll be kicking off the Christmas countdown with episode 238, which is post episode 237 for those that are good with numbers. And I know you guys will know what that's a reference to.
Mm-hmm.
I'm blanking, to be honest.
Okay. You're a really poor cinephile.
What have I done? What's 2-3? What's 237? 237 in cinema. Okay, let's type that into Ecosia. Room 23. Oh, The Shining. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. You know, I don't care for it that much. I don't care for The Shining. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's kind of overrated. I think it's definitely Kubrick's most overrated movie.
Wow.
Yeah.
Andy, your thoughts?
Bo's allowed to be wrong. And we are pairing that with another hotel-based movie.
Okay. Okay. Home Alone 2, Lost in New York.
Yeah, yes. Tim Curry, legend.
Another problematic hotelier.
Yes.
Violet, you can also be found at Three Circles, the Disney podcast on the Film Story Network.
Yes, with Jeff Owen. We are running the episodes now for our first season, getting ready to start recording the second season. Bo, you've been bumped up to the second season, so you'll have to watch that movie on YouTube sooner than you thought.
Thank you.
Thank you. Got him
right in time for
decom.
Right in time for fucking Oscar season. Thanks for that. Appreciate it.
That's no, right. We'll make sure you're good. Don't worry. We'll make sure. We haven't even started picking dates. I don't know. I'm all movieversaries all the time around here right now.
Yeah, you have been very, very busy over here. And my other show is Academy Watch, which will be starting up pretty soon because the Oscars is starting up pretty soon. The Oscars season, award season, that's where we talk about all that sort of stuff. So if you love Andy's voice, which you definitely should, you should check out Frame to Frame. If you love Violet's voice, which you definitely should, you should check out Three Circles. And if you like my voice, go to therapy. That's all I can say to you. Thank you so much. I texted this to Ian, but so Ian's partner, those not in on the joke, Ian's partner Carla was giving me a very tough time. And I should say her name is Carla, by the way. I should say it correctly, not Carla. But she was really having a go at us Australians in Bristol recently for the way that we say no and now. And, you know, I just happened to turn on the TV and it the last channel had like some reality show and there's a bunch of people around a dinner table. And the first thing I heard was, ah, no. And the first thing I thought of was Ian and Carla just being like, just laughing at me. So I texted Ian immediately being like, yeah, I just want you to know that now this is like ingrained in me. Anyway, thank you to Carla for that. And thank you to Violet and Andy for joining me and sharing your love for the Rocky Horror Picture Show. And thank you to everybody that tuned in as well. We hope you enjoyed the show. If you did, please subscribe to Movieversaries and give us a rating and a review wherever you can. And look, tell a friend about us, by the way. Like, that's probably a good way to spread the show. That would help us a lot. If you like the show and there's someone in your friendship group or family that loves movies, old movies particularly, tell them about us. And while you're here, you should also check out the show notes. We just talked about the other shows that we're doing. All the links will be in there for those. Thanks again for your company, and see you for the next installment of Movieversaries.